Lay it on. Just get in that surrendering space. Lay it on. This is the Bodhisattva's vow. Lay it all down.
Lay it all down.
In service.
I lay down my foolish pride.
All the pain I feel deep inside. Sorry. Holding back nothing, I lay it all down. I lay it all down, in worship. Hear the Dharma calling, come away. Hear the Dharma calling, come away. Hear the Dharma calling, lay it all down. So we have something that we call mantras. And mantras are like keys that open up doorways that allow us to pass through boundaries. And pass through the limitations of density or grossness. It's not just in Buddhism. We don't talk about it much in Buddhism because we like practical application. But practicality only takes us so far. And actually, this is practical. It's just outside the normal boundaries of what we understand and the soup we swim in. And the word that we have translated as attainment or achievement can also be translated accomplishment, could also be translated as the higher knowledge, the higher knowledges. And of course, you can't write a story before you can write a paragraph, before you can write a sentence, before you can make a word, before you learn the alphabet. So we're not going to deliberately go into a conversation about writing the book. Just want you to know that there are steps towards writing, being able to write a novel. One of them is that you have to know more than just alphabet, words, you know, symbols. There are other capacities that you have to have. Although without learning that, you won't be able to write the novel. But there are other things, other patterns, you know, that you have to also become proficient in. And what makes the difference between a good storyteller and a poor one, could you give me a glass of water? And the difference between, you know, a great novel and a mediocre one is all those other things that they can add to the telling of the story, to know how to grab your heart, how to trigger your memory, how to place you into the fabric of the story. And all of those are necessary and determine the quality and how the novel affects you, the greatness of the novel, all those other things interspersed with knowing the alphabet, knowing how to make words, knowing how to put sentences together into paragraphs, into a novel. And so we can't forget about all of those things. They're part and parcel of it. So no technique is suitable to bring about a desired result just on the basis of the technique. No method. So you could say the suttas are actually methods. And you have to employ more than one method. And it has to be in a way that who you're sharing it with can understand it. If I sit here, I love the Tibetan teachings. They're so flowery and they're so beautiful, but who can understand them? You know, and you love all of that, but you never think that that's for you. It just sounds really, really, really good. It sounds really, really high, you know. But what kind of effect can it really have on you if you don't understand it? So I'm grateful for teachers who can bring the Dhamma in a way that we can use our conventional language and understand it. Because it's really not that difficult. It's just a matter of an opening to a capacity to change our perspective. Thank you so much, sister. Excuse me. And I hope I've done enough repetition over the last 2 days, because I'm going to leave that now. But I never lose them. Since somebody bought me these, this is better than sliced bread. I want to tell you, I would lose like about 5 pairs of glasses a week. I still have about 25 in my drawer. But since somebody got me these, I wasn't gonna wear them old people thingies, that the little beaded necklace. And I thought, I can't wear that. And so they got me these. I love them. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the Dhamma is really just a matter of corresponding, you know, with the conditions and the practitioner's spiritual capacity. And when you get that right, quickly, it doesn't take eons. Quickly, one can attain to a higher state. We're already convinced that either we can't get it or that it will take eons and eons. And maybe because we've been in existence, this mind stream, for eons and eons, and we're just used to the long way. But there are methods that create shortcuts, that create hacks. It's like the Kubler-Ross thing. You can just go from 1 to 5. You can skip 2, 3, and 4 if you're so inclined. If you're not, no problem. Go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Go through the 5 stages, you know, or go through 4 of the 5, or, you know, or you can just go from 1 to 5. Or if you're well practiced, not ordinary, the Buddha called them ordinary, untaught, run-of-the-mill people, then you don't even have to do step one. When a circumstance arises, you can enter into step 5 because you understand it all together. So this is to try to give you some understanding. So you already know about the 5 aggregates. We dealt with them the last 2 days. And now we're going to try to observe the truth of the emptiness of the 10 illusory things produced from conditions. This truth of emptiness directly complements and enriches or completes the other side of the emptiness of self. The emptiness of self and the emptiness of all phenomena. Just, not just the self, but the emptiness of all phenomena. And what this does is it gives you a greater capacity to not move into the fixed nature of conditional reality, because from the beginning you see everything as illusory. So these 10 illusory things are produced from conditions are illusions, mirages, dreams, shadows or reflections, Mirage City, I'll tell you a good story about that, echoes, the moon reflected in water, floating bubbles, sky flowers, and a fire wheel made from a revolving flare. So it's like there's this flare, and when you turn around there, it looks like it's a circle of fire, but it's not actually a circle of fire. It just looks like a circle of fire. Okay. And I'd like to explain these in an explicit way so that you can understand them and how to use it as a tool, a method of how to see and be with this life that's so temporary, ever changing, never concrete, although so much of it seems concrete to us. Mm-hmm. This is how one should observe life and the phenomena, the things of life. It's a principle. It's like an illusion is a type of I would say a type of unreal appearance, an illusion. Did I really see something? Oh, there's the rocking chair and something's in the rocking chair. You wake up in the middle of the night, you think it's a ghost or a scary being. You cut the light on and it's the teddy bear that's sitting in the chair. Or that you see something curled up and you think it's a snake and you turn on the light and it's a belt or it's a rope, you know. But in the darkness, it appeared to be something and that was based on a fabrication of the mind. It was a fabrication of the mind. The mind saw that and thought snake cut on the light belt. So the difference was what the mind could fabricate going through its tick list of what things could be, how things could be, why things could be, and it picks some based on some prior knowledge of something. Like, I know how she is. I've seen her do this with other people. Or this is what my mind would say to do. That's what I would do. So that's probably what she's doing. Or, you know, whatever. The mind is weaving a story based on its data bank of things that it has seen, experienced, tasted, touched, smelled, or thought, right? And that's how we formulate our impression, our perception of our conception of what something is and what is happening right now. Okay, and that's how we see it. So it's this matter of prajna is like clicking on the light, and then you can see exactly what it is. You might have been thinking your best and it's really your worst. You might be thinking your worst is really your best, but like neither one of them last beyond the moment, the momentary occurrence. And when you see something like this, you're trying to think logically pragmatically how this came about and what to do with it. But sometimes there are other things that come into your periphery, particularly when you're in meditation. You know, has anybody been to see an illusionist? I mean, a really good one? Because I have, and I sat on the front row. And I mean, there's no way that could not have been. I was sitting on the front row, and the illusionist was right there. He's a very famous illusionist. And actually, I come to find out, like 30 years later, this illusionist was actually one of my master's students. And sitting on that front row, I could swear that what he did, that was not an illusion, that was a real thing. And then 30 years later, my master is telling me a story about something and about an illusionist that's one of his students, but that he had already moved to the place of city powers where he could transform phenomena and move things around, you know. And then I was finally vindicated, because all that time they were saying, no, it's not real, it's not real. I said, I know that was real. I was sitting right there on the front row, less than 5 feet in front of him, you know. But that was how he got so great. He's so great that he doesn't even do it anymore. Now he's doing a great thing with his abilities. That's not like tricking and dazzling people and making a boatload of money. But he did make a boatload. He did make a boatload of money. But now he's using it for the Dhamma. So his fame is gone. But yet he's using his skills and talents for the right purpose, to save living beings. And so some of us have had teachers or we've had masters, particularly Eastern masters, and we saw some phenomenal things, and maybe we were in our 20s or 30s, you know, and it just blew our mind, you know, how this could really be real. Everybody knows of Sai Baba and how Sai Baba could just take rocks and crush them in his fingers and they become gems. You know, how could you transform something like that? And you know, like, why would you use it for show and tell and for fame and fortune? And I'm not speaking disparagingly of Sai Baba. I'm just saying these things are not for games, but they can serve purposes. So when you start being really serious in your practice, and when you start seeing life as an illusion, something expands in your reality, and it's like finding out that there's the law of aerodynamics and it supersedes the law of gravity. Doesn't mean the law of gravity wasn't real, that it's now fake, false. The law of gravity works. You go up to the fifth floor, you jump out the window, you go down. That's it. But there are other laws that supersede the law of gravity. One of them that we know is the law of aerodynamics, and it speaks of certain properties. If you have a certain velocity, you have thrust, you have you catch the angle of the wind, and you put all, and you have gas in the plane. You put all of those together, you know, and you create lift. You pull back, and you create lift, and that supersedes the law of aerodynamics. It doesn't negate the law. It doesn't make the law of gravity of any less importance. In the whole scheme of things, the law of gravity is an existing law. This just happens to be another law that if it is exercised and you strategically and accurately meet the conditions for the law to spring into operation, then it will operate. And that we can accept that in the natural, but we can't so much accept that in spiritual things. You know, when they say that when... I think it was Columbus landed that the indigenous people, you know, the ships just came almost right up to the shore, but they couldn't see them because they didn't have a reference. They didn't have a mental reference for what it was, for what that was. And that's how they were able to just quickly come in and thought they were gods. I think my cat thinks I'm a god. You know, we know what time to feed. Two times a day. Instinctually, he gets hungry and he comes for food. We're one step ahead of him because we know that he feeds at 8 a.m. and 6 p.m. And he knows that we will have it there for him. When he doesn't feel well, we know he doesn't feel well. And we take him to the vet. Actually, he gets to the vet by divine transportation. He doesn't have to go on his pulse. Now, these are things that these are all within our concept of what's possible. You know, we can easily accept this. But when we step into this spiritual field, it has its own properties and it has its own laws. I could take you far into this. I'm just going to leave some food for thought. Okay. And so it has its own laws as well. That's all I'm saying to you. So when one enters into these spiritual dimensions, we call them the higher trainings, the higher teachings, and they're based upon the gateway to them is higher virtue, then we become aware of other laws that simply operate. You don't have to be pleading for something, begging for something. If you're in that the range of that possibility, it's like the dust that gets on your shoes. It's just automatically you inherit it because you're in the dusty territory. It's something like that. So if you can kind of understand it in this way, and you can be open to, will be open to seeing things that eyes haven't seen, ears haven't heard, hasn't even entered into your heart, but it's possible. 100 years ago, if we look at the difference in our science and our technology. I remember when my father died. He was born in 1899. And so, and I was his only child, and I came like after along in his 50s, you know. And so one day he said to me, he said, "Baby," he said, "I think I've lived long enough." He said, "I'm gone from man in a horse and a buggy to a man on the moon." He said, "There's only so much one can take in one lifetime." And about 6 weeks from that time, he was dead. About 2 weeks later, he stopped. He stopped eating, you know. And then a couple of weeks later, he stopped drinking. And then a couple of weeks later, he died. He didn't really die of anything. He just said, "Enough." He said, "I can't take anymore. I'm done." And so I just said that to say that if we give permission to tap into our wisdom roots. Some of us have probably lived thousands of lifetimes just taking in one drop of wisdom a lifetime. Oh, not this lifetime. I'm too busy having fun. I don't want to do any work. And it may have taken a long time. You don't know that mind stream. So I say, don't limit yourself. Sometimes we want something really bad, but the karmic force, the causes and conditions are not right. And sometimes we don't want something that bad, but want it or not, there you go. You got it, because there's a ripening of fruit and that consciousness is bursting into bloom. Just happens to be in your head, this life. And so you have it. You deal with it, or you don't. My daughter has what's called the veil. I don't have it, thank goodness. But the veil, my mother had it. And my daughter's granddaughter has it. So it's like it skips every other generation. I was lucky. But it's like she constantly sees dead people. And I'm talking to her, and she's saying, "Ma, this man just keeps walking back and forth across the kitchen." And I'm like trying to ignore him because I don't want to go there, you know. And I'm like, "Oh, is there anything I could do for you?" But I moved from being near the kitchen, you know. But this has been ever since she was a child. And I felt so bad because I did not know then how to help her, how to assist her. I didn't know what to do about this, and I didn't know anybody to take her to, you know. I didn't discount what she said because she could describe it all. She says, "There's another one hangs in the basement all the time. That's why I don't like to go down there, because he's an unruly kind of scary kind of guy. Only thing I would know to do was move to another house. Move to another house, then she sees other dead people in that house, you know. And then it dawned on me that it's not the house. You know, it's something that she's connecting with, you know." And so now she's in her 50s, right? And so I just asked her the other day, "Tasha, you still see dead people?" She said, "Oh, yeah, all the time, Mom." She said, "I'm just so used to it now." I used to ask, "Do you want me to try to help you find? I have resources now. You want me to try to hook you up with somebody who can help you?" She said, "Nah." She said, "I just let them do them and I do me. I just let them be in their world. And I know their world is overlapping with mine, but I don't feel to do anything with them and I don't want to." I'm like, okay. And I just leave it at that, you know? And so this is a real thing. And I can't tell everybody that because, well, first of all, they won't believe it, but they're not interested in anything beyond what their mind can totally accept here and now. No, but I leave that. So I don't have that. When he talked about that, once you get like in the zone, what they call the word for zone now? Flow. Yeah, like that's the new word. I think it might be going out by now since I know it. But if you're getting in the flow, there is a they tracked you know, with computers and stuff, one of these great athletes and how he went to jump for the basket, you know, and he was saying it's almost like impossible for how a human is constructed to be able to have that kind of lift and so forth. And they like studying it in college and everything. But here and there, someone steps into a field, you know, and it is always karmic because everything is karmic, you know, but it is the ripening of some karmic fruit in that mind stream that's in that particular body, that person. He can be a good person. He can be a bad person. But when that is ripening, it ripens. And that's why we can't just say like all those things, those wonderful things happen because she's so good. She just might be the four elements, the four elemental body that is carrying the mind stream, that whose karma is ripening. That's all. So she could be good or not good. If the karma is ripening, it's ripening. And so we judge from the outside what we think. And that's why we get so shocked when we find out something about somebody. Like, oh, I didn't know he was like that. Why? Because we were going by false appearances of the sixth sense basis. That's what Buddha said. He said, you need to know the law of causality. And then you won't be shocked by anything. That's not where I want to take y'all today, though. I just want you to know that. It says, I want to read it from our manual, but I want to skip parts. I want to skip parts. I want to talk about transformation of the four elements, transformation of the body. And it talks about after a practitioner has a certain degree of cultivated powers, sometimes he will produce a great ability when facing another party or when experiencing for himself the beneficial effects of his practice. Your practice has beneficial effects. Can't read you that story. Can't hear that one. I'm sorry, I'm in the wrong section. I don't want to give you any of this. Maybe 170. Okay. All right, I'm sorry. I'm in the right section. You can hear this. Okay. So today, as you watched appearing to the vastness of the emptiness behind the closed eyelids, and yesterday, you got a little inkling of the emptiness of space and that it has a form. There is something in this space. It's not just nothing. There is a sense of something in the space, and that is called the emptiness of space. It's the entity of vast boundless emptiness, and looking with the naked eye, you see nothing. It seems to have no appearance, but actually this no appearance carries within it an inherent sense of form. There is something here, even though it's not what? Graspable. It's not graspable. I can't grasp this space, and yet I can know that this is empty space. So it has a sense of form. It's just not a graspable kind of form, right? But the form does manifest in a way that we can recognize it as space. So space is an invisible dharma. In this sense, dharma, the word dharma means phenomena. You know that, right? It means phenomena, things. So that's a kind of emptiness. Another kind of emptiness is the emptiness of mind. That emptiness of mind is what we're trying to touch, and it is the space from when the last thought has fallen away and the next thought arises. That is called the emptiness of mind. And it is considered the perfect infusion of a state of absolute unimpeded ease and wisdom. It is out of that space all of the unknown that can be known becomes known. What you already know is known, right? So where you have a thought, and there's the knowing of something, the next thought, and there's a knowing of something. And between those thoughts lies the potential for everything that is unknown or something that is unknown to become known. So that's the space that we want to get in in meditation, is that we're sitting there at the portal to the unknown, what lies between two thoughts. And that becomes our new information. That becomes our new wisdom. So what happens with us if we're not alert and clear in our meditation is that we fall into muddledness or we fall into drowsiness. Muddledness or drowsiness. And in a state of non-attachment, what happens is that you can't tell where the mind is. It's the mind. It doesn't light or it doesn't land anywhere. And that's the non-discriminating mind. Actually, the Buddha said to enter Buddhahood is to enter the gateway to everywhere. To enter the gateway to everywhere. So we shouldn't be becoming more confined, more narrow. You know, we should actually be becoming more alive, more vibrant, you know, more blissful, more joyful, more accommodating, more, you know, we should be expanding in this way rather than contracting. And that's what was happening with the, you know, the spirituality that's not based on direct revelation. Is people get tied up, they get strict, they get staid, they, you know, get narrow-minded. And it's not always that there's something wrong with the teaching is something, it's not necessarily something wrong with the doctrine. It's not necessarily something is wrong with the theology. There's something wrong in the right application of it that causes one to miss the essence of it. So you have a principle that you understand, but not an essence that you transform into. So we're transforming into the essence of the words of the Dharma. And that's a different thing. That's what gives it life. And that's what gives it its capacity to change lives. It's called the perfect interfusion of state or capacity and wisdom. And so you have to examine yourself, like when I go into meditation, do I fall into muddledness and drowsiness? Well, then that can't be the liberating awakening state that he's talking about. So I need to do something else that doesn't allow me to fall into muddledness or drowsiness, even if it means I have to open my eyes, get up, wash my face, and go back and start again. And or if I have to remind myself of why I'm doing this. You know, or did I just get into the habit of doing this? Just like I got into the habit of, you know, what any other habitual tendency you have. Okay. So samadhi, then, is when one gets into the flow of this kind of jhanic experience until they are abiding in it almost all the time. And it is a different, spatially, it's a different place. It's a different place spatially. And it does have some repercussions on the body, and it affects different people different ways. Like I need to wear shades when I start to get into that space. Because everything takes on a kind of brightness that becomes too bright for my eyes. So I tried to fix that by having eye surgery. I went on and had like cataract surgery and that other thing old people get. I forget what the other one is called. glaucoma, right, yeah. So I had two of those things thinking I could fix it. But now I realized that that wasn't even the problem. So now I have to spend, I don't have to spend it because I've got some for the next year, $2,700 a month for drops that bring it down, bring the brightness down. But it had to do with my spiritual practices, you see. Not really. They had an effect on my eyes. I thought it was my eyes, but it was not. It was my spiritual practice having an effect on my eyes. So this is, it's like the stuff of the emptiness of the mind that is the truth. The fourth type of emptiness is the emptiness of dharmas. And that's a state that's realized by bodhisattvas. This state is established on the prerequisite of the emptiness of self. So you can't begin to understand the emptiness of phenomenal things if one hasn't tasted the emptiness of self, hasn't had the vision of the emptiness of self. And when you have it, it comes to you. You, as an insight, you realize something. But you know, these insights, they're so profound when you have them, but like 4 hours later, you know, it's gone. It's just like, oh, that was a good thought, or you even forget you even thought something. But these little insights are precious. So when you have one, you need to be with it so that it gets down, you know, into and forms a seed in the seventh consciousness, that it can be watered and bear fruit. But if you forget about it, then there's no watering and there's no growing and there's no bearing of fruit, right? So you have to lend time. So that's why the Buddha said, when you come out of meditation, you contemplate what just happened. What happened in there? What thoughts came to me? When those thoughts came to me, or some opening or some realization, why did it go away? What caused it to go away? You know, he said, and that's how you begin to sharpen and give full access to the Buddha consciousness that is already awakening. It's like knocking on the door, knocking on the door, knocking on the door. And you'll get better at this and better at this the more you do it. But if you never do it, you just sit, try to keep quiet your mind, get up and have a good day. Then you won't get anywhere. But allowing this wisdom to accumulate, reflecting on it, right after it happens, it's sort of like when you have a dream. When you have a dream, if you don't recall that dream by the time you get to the bathroom in the morning, you can forget about it. As much as you said as you were getting out the bed, you know, oh, wait till I tell so-and-so about this dream. That dream is gone before you hit the latrine, you know. But you can train yourself to review your dream. You can tell yourself, I need to wake up 5 minutes. Oh, yeah. I'm going to ask you that question in a minute. I need to wake up 5 minutes before I get up so that I can recall my dream. I can reflect on it. And you can even jot something down about it, an insight that you got from it, and review it a little bit later.